welcome to this month's episode of Style Points. Today, we are going to talk about an essential but very intense aspect of critical care. It's the go-to when everything else has failed. That's right, we're talking about ECMO with one of our most experienced ECMO specialists, Dr. Mohsen Zeddi. Before that, I'll turn it over to Nate Moore, who will introduce this month's RSI.
Thank you, John. I'm excited to introduce Dr. Lauren Brown, one of our interns, to the show. Lauren told me that one of her defining characteristics is that she loves sleep, which is perfect because she will be teaching us about obstructive sleep apnea. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks, Nate. Today I will be discussing obstructive sleep apnea, aka OSA, and its implications for anesthesia management. So first of all, what is OSA? Imagine trying to breathe through a straw that keeps collapsing every few seconds. That's what happens to patients with OSA during sleep. Their upper airway repeatedly obstructs, leading to interrupted breathing, oxygen desaturation, and increased cardiovascular strain. Let's talk about pathophysiology. OSA occurs when the negative airway pressure that develops during inspiration is greater than the muscular distending pressure, thereby causing airway collapse. Additionally, during sleep, laryngeal muscle tone is decreased, and apnea can occur when the upper airway collapses. Obstruction can occur throughout the upper airway, whether above, below, or at the level of the uvula. Because there is an inverse relationship between obesity and pharyngeal area, the smaller size of the upper airway and pharyngeal area in the obese patient causes a more negative pressure to develop for the same inspiratory flow, increasing the risk of obstruction and apnea. OSA is increasingly common, especially with rising obesity rates. Nearly a third of U.S. adults aged 30 to 69 have some form of sleep-disordered breathing, with 15% having moderate to severe OSA. OSA is undiagnosed in an estimated 80% of patients. The gold standard for diagnosing OSA is polysomnography, better known as a sleep study, in which a patient's breathing is monitored for episodes of obstructive respiratory events. The three events we're looking for are apneas, hypopneas, and respiratory effort-related arousals. Apnea is defined as a complete cessation of breathing for 10 seconds or more. Hypopnea is a little bit more complicated. It's defined as a 30% or greater reduction in airflow for at least 10 seconds, combined with either a decrease in oxygen saturation by at least 3% or arousal from sleep. A respiratory effort-related arousal is simply any breathing-related awakening from sleep that doesn't meet the criteria for a hypopnea. If your sleep study shows at least 15 obstructive respiratory events per hour of sleep, you get a diagnosis of OSA. You can also receive the diagnosis with only 5 obstructive respiratory events per hour, but only if you have OSA symptoms, such as snoring or daytime sleepiness. Once someone has a diagnosis of OSA, it's helpful to be able to say how severe their OSA is. Severity is usually estimated using the apnea-hypopnea index, or AHI, which is calculated as the combined number of apneas and hypopneas observed during a sleep study, divided by the number of hours of sleep observed, giving a rate of events per hour. OSA is traditionally classified as being mild, moderate, or severe, depending on the AHI. So mild would be anywhere from 5 to 14 events per hour, moderate would be 15 to 30 events per hour, and then severe would be greater than 30 events per hour. Treatment for OSA generally involves the use of positive airway pressure devices, such as a CPAP or BiPAP while sleeping. We'll leave the details to our sleep medicine colleagues, but just know that the patients with an AHI greater than 15 will generally be started on a CPAP. PAP or alternative PAP device. If the lack of detail starts keeping you up at night, then you may need to consider doing a sleep medicine fellowship. Anesthesiologists are eligible for it, or you may have OSA. Several OSA screening questionnaires exist. There's some controversy over their use, but suffice it to say they should only be used for patients with OSA symptoms. They are not effective as screening tools for asymptomatic patients. Perhaps the most popular OSA screening tool is the Stop-Bang questionnaire, where each of the 8 letters in Stop-Bang refers to a yes or no characteristic related to OSA. S is for snoring loudly, T is for tiredness during the day, O is for observed episodes of choking, gasping for air while sleeping, P is for pressure, that is high blood pressure, B is for a BMI greater than 35, A is for an age greater than 50, N is for neck size, typically greater than 16 inches, G is for gender of male. A score of 3 or higher indicates an intermediate to high risk of OSA, with higher scores indicating a higher risk of severe OSA. Now that we know who has OSA, let's talk about what we should do to take care of them perioperatively. OSA increases the risk of difficult airway management, postoperative respiratory depression, as well as cardiovascular instability. Preoperative evaluation aims to identify airway difficulties and potential cardiovascular complications from OSA. Chronic exposure to intermittent hypoxia and hypercarbic events while sleeping causes systemic hypertension and pulmonary hypertension. And the presence of pulmonary hypertension is particularly concerning, as it can lead to right-sided heart failure, which is difficult to treat as well as manage. It's reasonable to ask your patients about their level of adherence to their PAP therapy. If poorly adherent, they are likely at a higher risk of having cardiovascular comorbidities. Upper airway abnormalities and increased airway adiposity in patients with OSA predisposes them to be difficult to mass ventilate after induction for general anesthesia, and oral and nasopharyngeal airways should be readily available. Excessive pharyngeal adipose tissue can make exposure of the glottic opening difficult during direct laryngoscopy or endotracheal intubation. OSA can be even more of a challenge when performing sedation or monitoring anesthesia care due to the combination of an unprotected airway with the potential for severe sedation-induced airway obstruction. Nasopharyngeal or even oropharyngeal airways may be the key to maintaining acceptable ventilation, in addition to upgrading the usual nasal cannula to a face mask or even high-flow nasal oxygen, depending on the severity of OSA and the specific facial anatomy of your patient. OSA patients are highly sensitive to respiratory depressants like benzos and opioids. Strategies to minimize complications include using regional or local anesthesia when possible, which may allow you to avoid sedatives entirely, extubating patients in a semi-upright position, using short-active anesthetics such as Sevo and Prop, and multimodal non-opioid analgesia, avoiding nitrous oxide in patients with pulmonary hypertension, as nitrous can cause pulmonary vascular constriction, and then also employing supplemental oxygen in a small amount of PEEP post-extubation. Now that you've successfully gotten your patient through their anesthetic, it's time to think about their post-op care. OSA patients require close monitoring for post-anesthetic hypoxemia and respiratory complications. Best practices include positioning strategies to reduce apnea severity. Shoving a pillow underneath the patient's shoulder blades can help relieve an obstruction by increasing their upper neck extension. Additionally, elevating a patient's head or even placing them in a side sleeping position may help with ventilation. The use of non-opioid adjuncts such as NSAIDs, acetaminophen, tramadol, or regional anesthesia can minimize opioid requirements. And then encouraging CPAP use post-operatively. While there's mixed evidence for routinely doing this, it's likely beneficial for patients with OSA diagnoses that are already adherent to their CPAP use at home. As you can see, there are numerous considerations when caring for patients with OSA. Identification of at-risk patients and tailoring anesthesia plans to their condition can significantly improve outcomes, and it's definitely a diagnosis you want to be aware of before you start an anesthetic.
Mohsen Zeddi is an assistant, soon to be associate professor of anesthesiology at the University of Cincinnati. He did a fellowship in critical care. In addition to his many certifications and general expertise, he has been an invited speaker to discuss ECMO at the National ELSO meeting in 2024, and he's a faculty instructor who has taught multiple two-day courses in ECMO management around the country. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mohsen, what originally brought you to studying ECMO, learning more about ECMO? What's your journey been like for that?
Well, my first introduction to ECMO was during residency at University of Michigan, and then subsequently into fellowship. And I found the technology to be very, very interesting from a scientific standpoint, but what it does, but really the implications of it, and what it allows us to do for patients that was never allowed before, really just intrigued me. And so I got more interested in it. Would read more and more papers on it and literature, and spoke to experts, and really just it became one of my passions. And then when I got into practice, I joined the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization, ELSO, which is the national or truly international body that comes up the guidelines for ECMO, does a lot of research for ECMO, maintains a registry of all patients who've ever been on ECMO, provided the hospitals submit that information. And I joined them to learn more about ECMO, and then, as you mentioned, now actually instruct and teach other physicians, nurses, perfusionists, et cetera, on ECMO management.
So how big of a part of your day is ECMO management? Is that something you do every day, every week? What kind of scenarios are you utilizing your skill set?
So as you mentioned, I do both anesthesiology and critical care. So when I am up in the intensive care unit, our critical care team here manages the cardiovascular ICU, which at UC is the primary location for all ECMO patients. We inevitably have one ECMO patient at least every time I'm on service on average. I would say 1 to 3 is pretty typical. You know, we do go through some spurts where we don't have anyone on ECMO, which, you know, I suppose it's a good thing that patients aren't needing it. We are fairly a relatively busy program and usually 1 to 3. So when I am in the ICU, there's usually an ECMO patient on circuit.
So let me ask you, just backing up to one of my favorite get to know you questions. If you could invite anyone in the world over for dinner, could be somebody from the past or from fiction, who are you going to have over? Now, I remember you mentioned you'd have to think about this, so I'm curious what you've come up with.
You know, I came up with an unorthodox answer, and it's truly who I'd want to speak to, and that's my younger self.
Wow.
I would want to speak to them, to my younger self, and just not necessarily change things, because I'm not someone that tries to, you know, reshape the past or live with regret. Mostly to remind me to enjoy some of the things that maybe I didn't enjoy as much when I was younger, knowing what I do now and you know, this profession that we're all in or about to join, you know, it's a commitment and it takes a lot of time and you know, and sacrifice of you know, time or of experiences. And you know, I don't regret any of that, but I would remind my younger self to make sure and enjoy some of the other things life has to offer before embarking on this journey.
What age would you want to meet yourself or at what point in your life?
I think I would say probably junior high or freshman year of high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That'd be very interesting. I have thought about this a lot myself. Mm-hmm. One of the lectures that I give to medical students is it's called What I Wish Somebody Would Have Told Me. Mm-hmm. So I have thought the same thing, that it would be really nice to go back and tell my younger self some of these things too. Mm. So I'm with you there. That's a really neat answer. I've been asking this question for many years and people, I've never gotten that answer before. So that's pretty cool. Thank you. So could you start by backing up and telling us a little bit more about ECMO? So what did you see the first time that you experienced ECMO and what got you so interested?
Well, I remember seeing just someone on ECMO, you see these gigantic tubes of a patient's blood being removed from the body, spun through the circuit and through the specialized device that really is at the heart of the ECMO circuit, which is the oxygenator where gas exchange takes place, and put back into a patient. I'd never quite seen anything like that. This was prior to doing even my cardiac anesthesia rotation where, you know, you at least see bypass, but ECMO is not strictly cardiac bypass. It's a modified version of that. And I think what really struck me was seeing an awake patient on ECMO, because that was something I didn't, you know, even fathom as something possible, that you can be wide awake on ECMO. And this was, I think, my intern year, if I remember correctly, because we did a lot of ICU rotations in our intern year in my residency. And that really just the cool factor. That really just sold me on it.
So what does ECMO do? Why would somebody be on ECMO? What? Tell me more about it.
So in general, and I'll talk about the two types of ECMO in just a minute, but the essence of ECMO is you remove the patient's blood from their body. It's through a pump, usually a centrifugal pump, and it passes through a device called an oxygenator, where oxygen is pumped in, it diffuses into the blood, carbon dioxide is removed from the blood by the same device, and then the reoxygenated blood is put back into the patient. And that gets into the types of ECMO. There's ECMO for cardiac support, and there's ECMO for strictly lung support or respiratory support. And so if someone is in acute respiratory failure, refractory to all the normal things that we usually do, like mechanical ventilation, other things that have been shown to help, like proning a patient or paralyzing a patient, if none of these things help and you're on very, very dangerous settings on your mechanical ventilator, we're essentially causing more damage to the patient at that point than we're helping. And so ECMO will allow that patient to be on safe for mechanical ventilation settings or even no mechanical ventilation, and it will take over the function of the lungs. And so in that case, this is called veno-venous ECMO or VV ECMO. You take blood out of a vein, usually the inferior vena cava, pump it through the oxygenator. It reoxygenates the blood, which the patient's lung is currently not doing because it's so sick. It removes carbon dioxide, and then it pumps the blood back into the venous system. And the patient's native cardiac output distributes that reoxygenated blood everywhere. So
the VV ECMO then is the one for the patients whose heart is working just fine.
Correct. It provides no direct cardiac support. It is solely to take the function of the patient's native lung over.
That makes sense.
VA ECMO, veno arterial ECMO, is the one that supports the heart, and by definition also supports the lung. So in this case, blood is drained out from the venous system, just like in VV ECMO. But after it passes through the oxygenator, it's re-injected into the aorta or some sort of major artery, like the femoral artery. And that allows complete bypass of the patient's native cardiac cycle. And it takes over the function of the heart to an extent. And there's some nuances to that. But in general, if your heart is very poor, whether your lungs work or not, you would be placed on VA ECMO, and it would take over the function of the heart temporarily.
Okay, so VV ECMO for lungs, VA ECMO for heart.
That's correct.
Which one is harder to manage?
That's a good question. It really is patient dependent. I would say VA ECMO, if you're on VA ECMO, you're generally sicker just by the definition that your heart's not working well. And frequently that means the lungs aren't working, at least for a while. So I would say if I had to pick between the two, in general, VA ECMO patients are harder to manage. Now, there are some VV ECMO patients who just were very, very sick. And you know, certainly COVID comes up when I think of that. If you ask me what some of my sickest patients were, they were COVID patients who were just on VV ECMO, whose hearts were actually working okay, but their lungs were so sick. And other organs also were so sick that they were very, very difficult to manage because of how profoundly sick the COVID virus made them.
So what makes it so hard in COVID, for example? Mm-hmm.
So in the COVID population, what we found was it was very hard to support a patient's oxygen needs at the standard settings for ECMO, for VV ECMO. And so the way ECMO works, there's a certain flow speed. And so with VV ECMO, the blood that's directed into the circuit is a fraction of the patient's native venous return or the cardiac output, you know, which are one and the same as far as volume and flow. So the more you flow into the ECMO circuit, the greater percentage of venous return is oxygenated. So, you know, you and me right now, we have normal lungs, hopefully. And all our venous return goes through our lungs. It's oxygenated. The carbon dioxide diffuses out and it goes back. It goes into our heart, into our left side of our heart and out to the body. When you're on VV ECMO and you assume that the native lungs are so sick that they're not contributing to gas exchange at all, the ECMO circuit's doing all the work. But you can't take the entire venous return out of the body at once to oxygenate it. So you get as close as you can. But there's technical considerations. You know, the pump itself can only pump so fast. And so what we found in the COVID patients is their oxygenation needs were so great, not only because their lungs weren't working, but also the COVID seemed to just cause a profound decrease increase in oxygen needs. We just couldn't meet those in some patients, and it was very, very tough to maintain oxygenation. Whereas in a non-COVID patient with acute respiratory distress syndrome, usually we don't have that problem.
That makes sense. I remember dealing with a lot of ECMO patients during COVID.
Absolutely.
And I remember being all geared up and gowned up and having the full respirator face mask and doing some of the COVID trachs that we did in the ICU for some of these patients that were on ECMO support. And that's a time that I remember very well, but not necessarily fondly.
I 100% agree. It was a fraught time for a lot of critical care professionals everywhere. And you know, particularly when there were more patients that needed ECMO, or that could have, that, where ECMO could have helped patients, and we just didn't have enough. When I say we, across the country, not just here. And that was a very fraught time for all of us, certainly emotionally.
So COVID isn't the only thing that makes us put people on ECMO, certainly. Yeah. I wonder if you could paint a scenario for VV in a standard patient and a scenario for VA in a standard patient.
So yeah, VV, the most common use of VV ECMO is for ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Now, there are many causes of ARDS. The most common is either a viral or a bacterial infection or pneumonia that leads to a profound inflammatory response in the body, particularly in the lungs. And the lungs become so inflamed, the alveoli fill with fluid, and gas exchange no longer occurs to a significant amount. And so, you know, we'll generally put those patients on mechanical ventilation, try to do what we can to support them and get them through that process. As you know, with viruses, you essentially have to let them run their course. We don't have too many antivirals. If you you have a bacterial pneumonia, you treat it. But if that doesn't work, and you're using, again, as I mentioned, dangerous levels of mechanical ventilation, then we'll consider a patient for ECMO. And that will allow us to support their oxygen, the oxygenation and ventilation, while allowing us to decrease the ventilator settings that potentially are is causing more damage. So, you know, causes of ARDS other than viral and bacterial pneumonia, trauma can do it. Even if there's not an injury to the lungs, just the massive inflammatory response of the body could affect just the lungs. You know, some burn patients have that effect, either from an inhalational injury or, again, the massive inflammatory response. But by far and away, ARDS is usually from bacterial or viral pneumonia or some other infection that leads to it.
What about for VA?
So for VA ECMO, cardiogenic shock is the number one diagnosis for needing VA ECMO. Again, many reasons to have cardiogenic shock. There's ischemic cardiomyopathy, where if you have a very large heart attack, very large area of the myocardium is infarcted. The heart muscle is just weak, and it's so weak that it can't pump effectively. And then there's certainly non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, where, for instance, a viral myocarditis might cause a profound decrease in the ejection fraction. You know, normal is 60 to 65%. It may drop to 5 to 10%, which in some patients is just not enough to perfuse their body. And so they'll come into the hospital and we'll see that, and they are diagnosed with cardiogenic shock, and meaning a shock state caused by the decrease in function of the heart itself, as opposed to septic shock or other types of distributive shock or hypovolemic shock. And in that case, there are medications you can put them on, like inotropes, to try to kickstart the heart and make it pump a little harder. But those have their side effects, and sometimes they just don't work well enough. And so we would put a patient on ECMO to support their heart, take over the function of their heart. The other kind of a subset of VA ECMO that we do here, not every place that does VA ECMO does this, but there's the idea of ECPR, or extracorporeal cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And that is a patient who is actually arresting. So, I mean, there's cardiogenic shock, but the heart's still beating. And then there's pure cardiac arrest, you know, a VFib or a VTAC arrest. And they've been, you know, ACLS is initiated. We're doing CPR. We're giving epinephrine. We're giving all the, you know, we're trying to shock them out of it. And if it's refractory, which is generally in the literature defined as about 10 minutes, we might put them on ECMO emergently and essentially have ECMO take over the function of their heart while we're trying to restart the native cardiac function.
I have been in a few of those crash onto ECMO cases and ECPR. It's usually pretty exciting.
It is. Exciting is certainly one word to describe it. That, you know, as you know, John, codes are often controlled chaos, and ECPR is no different. But it's very nice that we have that program here, because it's different than just having a quote unquote plain old VA ECMO program. It takes more infrastructure. The way ECPR works here and in many other cities is, if somebody were to have an out-of-hospital arrest, we actually liaise with the city or the local EMS or the fire department. In this case, Cincinnati Fire Department, you know, liaises with us, and we have given them criteria saying if they respond to a cardiac arrest in the community around our hospital, and certain criteria are met, and those criteria include the type of rhythm, like a VTAC or a VFib, age of the patient, et cetera, they are to get them to the hospital as quickly as possible, not just do ACLS in the field, just to get them on into the ambulance, put a mechanical device that will do CPR for them, and bring them here as quickly as possible so that we can potentially put them on ECMO as quickly as possible. And time is of the essence, as with any cardiac arrest.
So we've said put them on ECMO a bunch of times. You've gotten the call. You need to go put someone at ECMO. What does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
What are the steps? How does that happen?
So to put someone on ECMO, is the term we use is cannulation. And so they will come into usually the hybrid room or the cath lab, some sort of operating suite or procedure suite that has imaging, in this case fluoroscopy, to help the cannulators put the large devices in where they should go. And so the first, generally in the case of, let's say, VA ECMO or ECPR, we'll go in the groin and cannulate the femoral vein on one side and the femoral artery on the other. And that's pretty typical. And in VV ECMO, you could do that as well, but with both veins. VV ECMO can also be the drainage cannula in the groin and the return cannula in the internal jugular. There's different cannulation strategies, but in general, we'll talk about fem-fem. So for VA ECMO, they will clean off or sterilize the groin with chlorhexidine. They'll stick a needle in, selling in their technique, like what we use all the time for central lines. They will access the artery, usually under ultrasound guidance. They'll access the vein on the other side. Once they get a wire in there, then it's a series of dilations, similar to what we do for a triple lumen or a MAC cordis or a trialysis line or similar device. However, these devices are much bigger. So your standard MAC cordis is about 9 French. Your trialysis line for temporary hemodialysis is 13 French. An arterial cannula for an adult is usually 17 to 21 French, sometimes even larger. And a venous cannula for ECMO in an adult is anywhere from 23 to 32 French. So these are gigantic cannulas, not much larger than the standard stuff we put in. And so once they access as wires in, you dilate up to these massive sizes, and then you put the cannula in. And then under fluoroscopy guidance, or you can also use transesophageal echo, if that's available instead, the tip of the cannulas are inserted up to a certain point. And, depending on what kind of cannula and what we're using, usually the venous cannula gets up to the cavoatrial junction. The arterial cannula will be put in the femoral. And usually we just want to make sure it's flowing into the aorta, right? And then once those are in, you will then hook them up to the circuit, start drawing blood out of the venous, and you're on ECMO at that point once you're on full flow. The circuit is usually primed with saline. In children, we might prime it with blood, but we generally don't do that with adults. Obviously heparin is given prior to putting in these large cannulas because you don't want the circuit to clot. Less doses smaller dose than what we give for cardiopulmonary bypass, but usually about 10,000 units IV heparin is usually given just prior.
So why would the blood clot?
Well, anytime blood is in contact with a non-organic surface, there's a risk of clotting. Now, I can tell you the modern ECMO circuit is such that the tubing and most of the components are coated with an anticoagulant proprietary coating to help prevent this. That being said, if clot were to form, particularly within the circuit, it could cause obstruction of the circuit. And just like an obstructive shock in the body, if your circuit is obstructed by a thrombus, it will not work and you won't be able to flow adequately. And it would be as if you're not on ECMO. And in the worst case scenarios, it stops the circuit completely and you just can't flow at all, which is a true emergency.
So I've got to ask, what do you do in the case where it's not a PE, it's not a heart attack, but your ECMO machine is becoming infarcted? What kinds of steps do you take there?
Mm-hmm. So if that's an emergency, and if we see... if it's a catastrophic obstruction from clot, we actually have to switch out the ECMO circuit. The way we do that, we leave the cannulas in because switching those out is not really practical, particularly when speed is of the essence. And so we will clamp off the circuit on both sides of the circuit, whether you're VV or your VA. We'll then cut the tubing and bring in a new circuit that's primed and reconnect them with special connectors. So it's essentially an entire change out of the circuit except for the cannulas. And while that sounds you know, very complicated, and it truly is. It's actually the fastest way to get someone back onto circuit rather than try to clean out the clot or, you know, certainly to replace the cannulas.
So that sounds really scary and dangerous, obviously. What are some other things that can go wrong with ECMO that you have to watch out for?
Well, so I mentioned heparin or some similar anticoagulant is used during cannulation. Standard of care is still to also run some sort of anticoagulant while you're on ECMO, again, to prevent this clotting phenomenon. And so anytime you're on a blood thinner, whether it's heparin or bivalirudin, et cetera, you run the risk of bleeding. And so other than clotting, bleeding is the other most common complication on ECMO. And bleeding doesn't have to happen where you put the ECMO cannulas in, although that certainly does occur. Sometimes you just start having gastrointestinal bleeding, or whether it's upper or lower, or uterine bleeding, or just oozing from other sites of the other equipment, like central lines, et cetera. And that's a problem. And then it becomes even more of an issue if the patient needs some sort of surgery or procedure done while on ECMO, which does occur, you know, and that's where we really run into problems with bleeding. And so we may have to pause anticoagulation at that point. There are some centers that have started running patients on ECMO without any anticoagulation after the initial bolus. And while that's currently not standard of care, more and more emerging research suggests that that may be safe to do.
Since they're using some of that proprietary coating to prevent
the clotting. That's correct. Yes. The early ECMO circuits, you know, back in the 90s and before, did not have this proprietary coating, or it certainly wasn't as good back then. And a lot of the early data on ECMO was very negative, and it was mostly because of bleeding complications. And that, thankfully, through, you know, innovation on the biotech side, they've really gotten these circuits to the point where they don't clot off like they used to. And therefore, you can get away with running lesser amounts of systemic anticoagulation. Or as I mentioned, some places, particularly for VV ECMO, don't run anticoagulation as standard.
So let's say for an anesthesia resident who hasn't managed one of these patients before, you learn maybe the day before that you are going to be doing some sort of procedure on one of these ECMO patients. Mm-hmm. What kind of advice would you give them? What would you tell them to keep in mind for these ECMO patients? What to do, how to manage it? What comes to your mind?
So the first thing you want to figure out is what type of ECMO support they're on. Because you're going to manage the patient differently. So if they're on VV ECMO and their heart's otherwise working okay, that gives you some good information on what you're going to have to manage, versus if they're on VA ECMO and essentially the ECMO circuit is taking over their heart and lung function at that point. So once you figure that out, you need to, you know, you, as with any ICU patient, see what drips they're on, your sedatives, et cetera. You know, if they're still intubated, which they normally are, but there are going to be some patients that are extubated who are on ECMO. But assuming they're intubated, you can still, you know, quote unquote, plug and play and bring them, when you bring them down, plan to hook them up to your anesthesia machine. You can still deliver anesthetic agents and inhaled agents through the tube, and it'll still anesthetize them. Even if some of that is diverted through the circuit, it doesn't affect, you know, it's a clinical effect. So when you're talking about the actual sedation plan, that should still be the case. If they're on IV sedation, that's also okay, which is what we use in the ICU. You know, if they're on propofol, et cetera, all that's okay to use. There's really no restrictions on that. When you're talking about management, so if they're on any kind of ECMO, as I said, their oxygenation ventilation is being taken care of by the ECMO circuit, whether that's VV or VA. And so I think it's important to realize a couple things that you'll see when you hook up a patient to your anesthesia machine who's on ECMO. The first thing you'll notice is because we're not using their lungs, we're using the ECMO oxygenator to be their lungs, you'll notice their end-tidal CO2 is very low. And so low that if it were that low on a normal patient, you should be calling for help. We're talking about, you know, it might even be 10, but don't be alarmed, because that's normal in a patient on any sort of ECMO where the circuit is doing the lung work for them. So the circuit is removing the carbon dioxide, so there's less of the native lungs, less for the native lungs to breathe out. So that's why you see a lower end-tidal CO2. If you run into hemodynamic issues, you know, and you're on VA ECMO, you have to realize that while you can still give some medications, you know, like vasoconstrictors, because that you can still be vasodilated on ECMO and that could still cause hypotension, you also have to communicate with the person running your ECMO circuit, which is usually an ECMO specialist or perfusionist or nurse, and communicate with them that, hey, you know, we're running into perhaps hypotension. Is there anything you can do on the ECMO circuit to help? So it's gonna be a lot more communication because you have somebody else managing the patient. It's not just all you like we're used to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's tough taking things out of our hands, I suppose. We're kind of control freaks in anesthesia.
Yes, very, very much so. And it really is important to communicate with not just the perfusionist or whoever is running your ECMO circuit, with your ICU team, with your surgeon, about what might be happening. Certainly bleeding during surgery, you know, oftentimes we will pause the anticoagulation, as I mentioned previously, for bleeding or to prevent bleeding. So let's say you need to have, you know, a section of bowel removed while on ECMO, which has happened. You know, we'll usually hold the anticoagulation so that there's not a ton of bleeding during surgery. That being said, if the surgeon runs into bleeding, that is going to affect your ECMO circuit just like it would have affected your patient if they had their native cardiac output running. And that's something to keep in mind, that, you know, volume management is still something to keep in mind on ECMO. You still have to do volume management. If you lose volume, you have to give it back because the pump will only pump what it's given. So if it's given less, it's going to pump less. And so at a given volume, you have a certain flow rate, let's say 4 liters a minute. If you have 500 of blood loss all of a sudden, that flow rate at the same speed of the pump is going to go down. And that means less support. That's as if your patient's cardiac output is decreased. So it's going to be less support for the patient. That is still up to you, the anesthesia provider, to fix.
Yeah, that makes sense. One thing that I used to have questions about before I finished my anesthesia residency is I would see a patient on ECMO and I would wonder about just some of the general monitors I would need. Does every ECMO patient need an arterial line, or does a blood pressure cuff work sometimes? Can you help elucidate some of that for us?
For VV ECMO, as long as their heart's working okay, you technically don't need an arterial line for hemodynamic monitoring. I think most of us would feel better with one. I think no one would fault you for having one, but there are certainly places that run VV ECMO without an arterial line, and that's not uncommon, or to give someone a break from an arterial line, especially if you're on VV ECMO for a long time. Honestly, for VV ECMO, the arterial line is less for hemodynamics and more to easily draw arterial blood gases without having to sick the patient each time. Now, for VA ECMO, personally, I can't imagine a scenario where I wouldn't have an arterial line in such a patient, and that's because an arterial line gives you a lot of information. It gives you your real live or real time measurement of your mean arterial pressure, which is what you generally titrate your ECMO flows to, again, on VA ECMO. The other thing it does is it shows you pulsatility. So the point of ECMO is to allow the native organ function to return. It's to buy time. It is not a cure. Being on ECMO doesn't cure the lungs. It buys time for the lungs to recover. Being on ECMO, if your heart's not working well, buys time for your heart to recover. Now, the other side of that coin is it could also buy time for a transplant if you're a candidate, but that's a more fraught decision and there's a lot of criteria that has to be met. But in general, ECMO is to buy time. And so for an arterial line, or the other purpose of an arterial line in VA ECMO, is to see if the heart is recovering. And what you'll see is you might initially, when the heart's sick and not working very well, you might see a relatively flat A-line tracing or maybe a very small deflection with cardiac output. As the heart gets stronger while on ECMO, you'll start to see pulsatility come back on your arterial line tracing. And that's usually our first sign as the ECMO team that, oh, maybe the heart's starting to recover from whatever insult caused the problem in the first place. So it's very helpful for that. Now, for a procedure, you know, going down into the OR or to a procedural suite, as an anesthesiologist, I definitely want an arterial line for VA ECMO. For VV, I think it would depend on the procedure. I'd still feel better with one. But just realize that an arterial line on VV ECMO, you're still measuring the cardiac output of the native cardiac output.
So we talked about reasons why to put somebody on VA or VV. The heart's not working, the lungs aren't working. How do you make the decision to try to turn the ECMO off? How does that work?
That's a very difficult decision sometimes. Certainly if we see evidence of lung function or heart function return, we'll do trials off ECMO. And when I say off ECMO, it differs for VV versus VA. So for a VV ECMO, we will just stop the gas flow to the ECMO machine, so that while the blood still goes through the machine, nothing's actually happening. No gas exchange is actually happening. We're relying on the patient's lungs to do the work. So we will turn off the gas flow to the ECMO circuit on VV ECMO, but allow blood to still come out and go back in, which doesn't actually affect much. And we'll see how the patient does. We'll see what their pulse ox shows, what arterial blood gas shows. And we want to see if oxygenation and ventilation has returned to normal or close enough to normal that we would feel comfortable coming off ECMO. And so there's not true strict criteria. There's some kind of algorithms we use to see if a patient's ready to come off VV ECMO. With VA ECMO, it's a little tougher. I mentioned earlier that even though it's for heart support, a lot of times a patient's lungs aren't great either when they're in cardiogenic shock. Because as you know, with cardiogenic shock, you can get pulmonary edema and a backup of fluid into the lungs. And it's not uncommon for the heart to recover before the lungs do when that happens. So with VA ECMO, we need to make sure the lungs are working and the heart's working. And sometimes, we'll do a trial where we turn down the flows on VA ECMO. So therefore, less support is being offered by the circuit and more blood is returning to the patient's heart. And we'll see how the heart does. And we'll look at the arterial line and the MAP. Does the MAP go up? The mean arterial pressure. If they have a Swan-Ganz catheter, we'll see if those numbers look good. Often we'll do it under echo guidance, either a transthoracic echo or a transesophageal echo, and just look directly at the heart and just see how its function handles getting more blood back to it rather than it going through the ECMO circuit. And if you pass that criteria, you're decannulated. In VV ECMO, they pull the cannulas out of the veins and hold pressure for a long time. They usually do that at the bedside. For VA ECMO, often the arterial cannula, when it comes out, the artery needs to be primarily repaired. However, that's not always the case. In the situations where a patient has been on ECMO for a while and you don't see evidence of recovery, that gets really tricky. You have to then think about, okay, is this patient a transplant candidate, whether it's heart or lung? And unfortunately, a lot of times they're not. And that's because they get sick, just as part of their illness, other organs go bad, particularly the kidneys. And those things could preclude them from getting a transplant, at least at that time. And, ECMO is supposed to be temporary. It's not meant to be long term. The longer you're on ECMO, the more complications you accumulate. And so at some point, we have to have very difficult conversations with a patient's family or sometimes even the patient when they're awake, wide awake with it, extubated on VA ECMO, let's say, and able to make their own decisions. And thankfully, that's not super common, but it's very, very difficult to have those conversations saying, we don't feel there's any meaningful recovery that's going to happen. Your loved one or you, the patient, is not a transplant candidate, and we can't keep you on ECMO forever because you're accumulating complications that are going to be detrimental. And there are instances where we have to withdraw care from, and turn off the ECMO machine, and that will result in the patient's death, either usually quite quickly or within a few days.
How do you start to approach those conversations with the patient? What kinds of things do you have in mind? What's going through your head?
My personal approach is to be very pragmatic with them and discuss their care. And I give them, particularly, it's usually with the family, but if it's the patient and they're with it, they often know how sick they are, but sometimes they don't. And I paint the picture of, go down every organ system and say where it's good and where it's bad. And I tell them both, like, all right, this organ system's working, but this one's not. Your liver's working okay, but your kidneys are shot and you're on dialysis. And I don't know when you'll come off or if you'll come off dialysis. Your heart is just not recovering. And if we were to take you off ECMO right now, you would pass away immediately. Your lungs are not recovering. We don't anticipate they're going to recover anymore. And they're not working well enough that you can be off ECMO. I'd be very almost blunt with them on that, because I don't want to give a sense of any kind of false hope But I also don't want to, you know, be cruel. And so I try to balance that. And it's a hard thing to do. And then I talk to him about that. I paint that picture. And then I say, here are the options. We could keep on ECMO. We could wait longer for recovery or transplant. And then I go through the risks and benefits of those. In some situations, I don't offer to keep them on ECMO because of the various issues that they're having. And I'll usually have the palliative care team or, you know, other specialties that can help me paint this picture. So if we're worried about neurologic status, have neurocritical care or neurology come talk. If it's the patient's not a transplant candidate, maybe have cardiothoracic surgery come talk and explain why they're not a candidate. And I've found that approach and that multidisciplinary approach really helps families understand. And the biggest thing is I try to give them time. I try to start that conversation early when we suspect that this is not going to go well, that the outcome is not going to be ideal for this patient.
Now, from my understanding, ECMO is something that is complicated. It's hard to do. It takes a lot of specialists. It takes an expensive machine. What are some of the financial resource implications for using an ECMO machine? What kind of cost to the healthcare system does an ECMO machine cause?
That's a good question. I don't have specific numbers as far as cost, because with every patient it's different. But ECMO is very expensive from a technological standpoint. You know, the pumps are expensive, the tubing is expensive, the oxygenator is expensive. And then from a manpower, standpoint, it's a true team that takes care of an ECMO patient. You have physicians, you have nurses, you have advanced practice providers, you have perfusionists or ECMO specialists, you have respiratory therapists, and then, you know, you still need nutritionists, et cetera, all the things that come with a critically ill patient. But the addition of some of these other specialists are expensive. And you know, you also need to have, as a hospital system, enough of those people to take care of ECMO patients and, you know, other patients that they have to attend to. So it's a very, very expensive from personnel and from equipment standpoint for a hospital system to have an ECMO program. And so some hospital systems only do one type of ECMO. Some hospital systems have the ability to cannulate for ECMO, but then ship the patient to a center like ours to manage the patient long term. And that's very common around our region here, where a lot of hospitals can cannulate for ECMO, particularly VA ECMO, but then they'll transfer the patient here for long term management. And that's just because of the costs involved. It really is resource intensive. It takes specialized training. You have to, if you aren't in a critical care fellowship where you had ECMO patients, you really need to seek out other training. Most, I would say, but most critical care anesthesiology fellowships are at centers that do have some ECMO, but I'm sure certainly not all of them do.
So ECMO, despite all the costs, despite all the complications and the ethical things that can come up, can work too. I remember specifically one ECMO patient that I took care of when I was in my intern year. They had somebody who had been found down for an unknown period of time, and she had unfortunately gotten very cold, and she was in cardiac arrest. And they brought her to the ICU and hooked up the ECMO cannulas at bedside and started it up. And I remember ending my shift that day close to the time where a lot of that was going on. And I was sent home. I needed to come in the next morning. And I felt conflicted about it because I remembered feeling, wow, I don't know what benefit this is going to have, because I feel like this patient is, for all intents and purposes, is dead. And I'm not sure what we're doing here. This is a really dramatic intervention that I'm not sure what could happen here. And so I went home, I thought about it. I came in the next morning and got report, and I was waiting to hear back, you know, that the ECMO patient had passed away, of course. And I came in for a report, and the overnight person said, well, the ECMO patient is actually complaining of you know, such and so, and I don't even remember what she was complaining about, but it stopped me sort of dead in my tracks. I was like, what? She's complaining? That that means so much. I mean, wow. And she actually walked out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. So it's an intervention that is complicated and is fraught with all sorts of financial, ethical issues. But it really can work in some of these cases.
Absolutely. And that's why we keep doing it. And that's why it's becoming a little more common to see, even in smaller centers. For a while, it was only in large academic centers or tertiary medical centers. And now you're starting to see it out in the community because it has a good success rate. So, you know, ELSO, the organization, keeps a live database, and all of the, with the exception of ECPR, which is a kind of a separate entity, VA, VV, ECMO patients in adults have a, you know, over 50% success rate. And these are patients who otherwise had very high mortality, predicted mortality with their initial issue. It really is. I have countless stories of where patients who absolutely should have died or should be dead are alive and neurologically intact. And that's another big one, is there's being alive and there's also being alive and functional. And that's looked at a little more now with the ECMO research, and we're still seeing good results that you're not just alive, you're walking out, or you can still lead a meaningful life after being on ECMO. And, you know, it's certainly dramatic with ECPR. I'll actually be lecturing at the Society of Critical Care Medicine's annual congress coming up next month about this. ECPR, you know, most out-of-hospital arrest, about at most 10% survival rate with standard ACLS. With ECMO, with ECPR specifically, at a center that knows what they're doing, 30%, which, you know, is still not great, but sure beats 10%, you know, and it's only going to get, hopefully only going to get more. Now, at some point, you know, other factors come into play, but it has absolutely saved lives. It continues to save lives. There are several patients that I can think of off the top of my head that had the same reaction as you, as I couldn't believe that person's alive. One quick anecdote. I remember in my CA3 year, I believe it was, I'm sorry, I was a CA2. It was a Saturday morning, and the labor and delivery area was in the Children's Hospital at Michigan. So it's Mott Children's Hospital. It's called the Women's and Children's Hospital. Two floors are labor and delivery. The rest is all peds. And it was completely resident run at the time. It was two of us there with an attending who was a peds attending, but kind of moonlit on the weekends covering the OB service. And we come in the morning, and there was a patient who was septic, unfortunately had an intrauterine fetal demise, but had gotten septic overnight. They were planning to do the dilation evacuation that morning. She was inpatient, obviously. And while we were in our 7 a.m. sign out, and mind you, on a weekend, like I'm sure at most places where we got skeleton crew, you know, just the bare minimum to get through the day. The code alarm goes off, and we run there. She's not actually coding, but she's profoundly hypotensive. She's gray. She's clearly not oxygenating well. So we rush her to the OR, intubate her. They pull out the products of conception, which were grossly infected, and she codes. And we call for help. There was not a lot of help to be had. The pediatric anesthesia team happened to be between cases downstairs, so they came to help us. We called over to the adult side. They were all busy. I think one person called. I called to the surgical ICU and see if the, which was in the adult hospital, and said, "Hey, can you send the fellow over at least to help?" We could not get her back. We assumed it might have been an amniotic fluid embolism, but combined with septic shock, we could not get her back. She was otherwise a completely healthy 38 or 37 year old, and we made the decision to ask. The surgical ICU fellow came over and said, "Would this be an ECMO candidate?" And we said, "Yeah, we can't think of any contraindication." And so, long story short, they essentially, it was an ECPR case. The cardiac surgeon who cannulates happened to be in house doing residency interviews. That's the only reason he was close by.
Wow!
And he came over, cannulated, and she came to the CVICU. We took care of her. She was decannulated about a week later. And I remember seeing her on her day of discharge to rehab. She was completely neurologically intact. And actually, I asked her for permission to present her case at ASA, which I did that year. But she was completely intact. She thankfully didn't remember any of it, which it's always a surprise in the critical care world that a lot of patients, even without any sedation, just don't remember those things, which is good. I mean, that's just one of countless stories I have that this technology saved a life when it otherwise would have gone the other way.
That's really cool. And I appreciate you sharing that with us. So lastly, sort of to wrap up, I wonder what style points you can share with us, points of personal preference, things that have gotten you further in your career or that you just think are really good pieces of advice for people.
For me personally, I think being practical when talking with patients, when talking with colleagues, you know, sometimes being blunt, just so, you know, people see you as genuine and see you as somebody that tells it like it is. And sometimes you have to have those hard conversations, and it may not always endear you to people. But I found for me personally that has helped with my career, helped me talk to patients, helped me deal with colleagues, particularly difficult, you know, colleagues. We're all going to have, you know, interactions with folks in the future that don't always go well. And you have to handle that professionally. But at the same time, stay kind of true to yourself and really make sure that you respect yourself in those situations. And I find that I have gotten more better outcomes out of those situations being you know, assertive, but not, you know, not mean, not unprofessional. And sometimes that's a hard you know, particularly in the operating room environment, that can be tough. And that's a skill that you have to perfect over time. And it's never too early to start working on that.
Mohsen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for joining us for this month's episode of Style Points. Style Points now has stickers featuring the new logo. If you're interested in a sticker, feel free to find me in person and I'd be happy to get you one. They go great on travel mugs. If you aren't in Cincinnati, you can email me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com and I would be happy to send a sticker your way. If you enjoyed the show, please keep telling your friends and consider giving us a 5-star rating. Or even better, you could be one of the first people to leave a review on the podcast. Reviews really do help the algorithm, or so I'm told, which will help this podcast's goal of eventually achieving total world domination. Take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.